Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, this is the Red Box Podcast and The Times. I'm Matt Chorley. Something special for you this week, a recording of an event I did with Ed Balls, former Shadow Chancellor and now star of Strictly, and Philip Webster, former political editor of The Times, who worked for the paper for 40 years, where we spent a terrific evening with 300 Times readers covering everything from keeping Britain out of the Euro, the state of the Labour Party and the lumber. This is part one of the event recorded live at the Emanuel Centre in Westminster.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome here to this terrific venue for what I'm hoping will be a fascinating evening covering everything from the politics of the 1970s to the lumber. I'm Matt Chorley. I'm the editor of the Times Red Box. My main job is getting up very early in the morning to write an indispensable guide to what's happening in politics, which is in your inbox, hopefully, when you get up every morning. If you haven't signed up already, you won't be able to leave the building until you have. It's thetimes.co.uk/redbox email, and I'll be doing that again later. We are also live on Facebook, so please don't storm the stage. Because that will go viral and it'll be all embarrassing for all of us. We are also using the hashtag TimesPlus, that's P-L-U-S, not the plus, just to make that as complicated as possible. And I think that's all of the housekeeping we need to deal with. I'm delighted to be joined by two best-selling authors. I can't claim to have written a book, but I'm delighted to be joined by Philip Webster. Let's stick to the script. We'll start with Ed Balls. Otherwise, I'll completely lose my way. You'll have to guess who the other one is in a minute. So Ed Balls, of course, started out as a journalist, which we'll hopefully touch on this evening, as lead economic writer at the Financial Times, before being lured into the idea of doing things rather than just reporting on other people doing them. He went then to work for Labour Shadow Chancellor Gordon Brown in 1994, and was by his side for the next more than decade, speaking to him every day for 13 years, a job that not all of us would want. He then became an MP himself in 2005, later Children's Secretary, and then in opposition he ran for leader before a brief spell as Shadow Home Secretary, Shadow Chancellor under Ed Miliband, and then, of course, the shock of losing his seat last year. I don't really know what he's been doing since then, so hopefully we'll be able to... We'll be able to touch on some of that as the evening goes on. Ed's book, Speaking Out, is available in all good bookshops and several bad ones. And Philip Webster also has a book called Inside Story. Phil started out on the Eastern Daily Press, is that right? Absolutely. Before joining the Times as a result of his famously fast shorthand, which would be a very niche Times Plus event if it was all about shorthand. But it was Phil's famously fast shorthand which got him the job at the Times, where he then spent 43 years, including 18 years as political editor. And he covered it all, and he covers it in great detail in his book, from the night Michael Heseltine swung the mace around his head, the night the Callaghan government fell, the day Sir Geoffrey Howe brought down Margaret Thatcher, the day Tony Blair said farewell, the night MPs voted for war in Iraq. I've just realised that's in the wrong order, isn't it? And then, of course, the extraordinary rise of Jeremy Corbyn. And he even then, having retired, ended up covering Brexit as well in his book, which we'll touch on. And Phil launched Red Box, and I then inherited the mantle of getting up really quite early in the mornings to do that. So I've got Phil to blame for that.
That was really why I retired, of course.
Yes, but, you know, yeah, I feel like I'm ready to retire as well. So, what's interesting is that you're not just here because you have two people who've both got books out and your paths never cross, because actually you both know each other very well. And I think what's interesting is the way that your paths cross at various particular points, whether that's football or politics, or you were strictly on Saturday night, the curse of Phil Webster.
Yeah. To see it end.
So I don't know who wants.
Thank you, Phil.
I don't know who wants to start, but just talk me through how your paths first met, because you've got so much in common.
Well, I first knew Ed. He was still, I think, on the FT when it came to my notice that he could play football. I used to run an all-stars football team.
And all-stars, you say?
All-stars football team, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So, when I got to know Ed, we discovered within about 25 seconds that we were both Norwich City supporters. I didn't know until then that Ed was born in Norwich. And I suppose we became friends from that moment. But, of course, he then went to work for Gordon Brown, then an MP. Although he was been a friend all those years, I had to treat him as I would treat any other source, advisor, MP. I don't think I was
lavishly.
Ever, yeah.
Things there are they aren't so lavish now. I can assure you.
There are in that book several examples of stories that I wrote that Ed didn't like. The fact that we were friends didn't stop me writing what had to be written, as you'd expect from a political journalist working for the Times. There's one classic story where. I did write a story that the Treasury did not want to see, and it started with Charlie Whelan calling me, then Ed, and then at just after midnight, Phil, it's Gordon here. And that happened on a particular story in 97, which I'm sure you remember. Ed didn't try to talk me out of it.
What was the story?
It was a story, the IMF had done its first report on the early months of the Labour government in 97. I was given an advance sight of this by friends at the Treasury, and the Treasury thought the story was that the IMF had said that Labour was running the economy brilliantly.
Obviously, yeah.
Obviously. I read through the report and found that the IMF was also saying that the Labour government might well have to put up taxes quite soon. I thought that was a better story, and that led to that chain of events. Ed didn't try and talk me out of it. Being a journalist, he knew. He made a duty call. Gordon had a good go, and I stood firm.
And Ed, what was it like for you being on the other side of that fence of being friends with Phil, but also having to deal with that relationship?
I was born in Norwich in 1967, and it was, I mean, to meet the man who wrote the authorised biography of Kevin Keelan.
He was a Norwich City goalkeeper,
Benefit of anybody who doesn't know about Norwich football.
One of the great moments of my life.
It's not Kevin Keegan, just to be clear.
Kevin Keelan.
Keelan, yeah, there we are.
He was actually known as Kevin the Cat Keelan. And Phil was, I think, a Norfolk reporter at the time and wrote this biography.
I joined the Times, but when I wrote it. Yeah. I'd wrote it during the Times closure.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then we did... I think I actually played football with you for... the press against the MPs, and then for the MPs against the press.
Yes, you turned.
The reason why Phil's is such a fascinating book is not only because he's been here in politics for so long and written so many fabulously brilliant stories. Phil had the exclusive about John Major's affair with Edwina Curry, for
example.
Don't go showing
my script again.
He'll tell us later what his sources were and whether he was whether it was first hand or second hand.
I wasn't in the room.
Whether John Major popped out for a curry, the thing about Phil is that he, even though he had people he had friendly relationships with. He was somebody who was respected by all sides of politics, by Labour and Conservative, or even, the even bigger divides, Tony Blair and Gordon Brown. He was respected on both sides for being fair and scrupulous, and if Phil wrote a story, you knew it was correct, and he didn't take a punt, and he wasn't somebody who made things up. And Phil, has a, it says on the back of his book, some great tributes. They're correct. He was the journalist of the highest integrity and trusted on all sides to be fair and scrupulous. And I think in modern media, that's really important.
Right. Well, that's the end of the loving, I think. I don't think we want any more of that. Let's go back, because you, Phil, you touched on it a bit about how you wrote this, the book of Kevin Keelan, when the Times was closed.
And actually, Kevin the cat, Keelan.
Kevin the cat. And actually, you touched on the book about how you wrote the last Times splash from...
Yes, I mean, I read...
Grazing Road, and then the first one when
the... Yeah, when the Times moved to Wapping from Grazing Road, it was in the middle of the Westland crisis, if you remember the great row, which prompted Michael Heseltine to walk out of the cabinet over whether it was a European or an American manufacturer. And the last splash out of Grazing Road was Leon Britton under pressure to resign over Westland. And then overnight, virtually overnight, we were on the Friday night, I was on a trip. Leon Britton had indeed resigned on the Friday, after I wrote that Friday splash.
That's a relief.
And I was waiting on the platform at King's Cross to catch him and go with him north. In those days, obviously, no mobiles, but I rang the office and they said, don't bother to go with Britton, we're not publishing tonight. And I said, why? They said, just come to the office. And I ran from King's Cross down to Grazing Road to see what was going on. And that was the point at which the editor of the day, Charlie Wilson, stood on a table, shaky table, and said, Times not publishing tonight. Times will be published on Sunday night from Tower Hamlets. He didn't say Wapping, he said Tower Hamlets. I thought, where the hell is Tower Hamlets? Looked up a map, found my way to Tower Hamlets on the Sunday morning, walked through the picket line, which wasn't pleasant because I knew most of the guys there. I'd worked with the printers for several years already. It wasn't nice. And then I wrote the splash that Sunday for Monday, which was Thatcher's fight back over Westland. She was really shaky. It looked at that point that she might go. Things were so bad. There was a big row over the leaking of the Solicitor General's letter. And funnily enough, it was during that, while I was... We had no telephones in the office on that day. I'd never used a computer in my life. Murdoch had sent over a team of women from America to show us how to use computers. And that was the first time I'd actually sat at a keyboard. My only source for the day, as I couldn't phone anywhere, I couldn't phone politicians.
Why were there no phones?
Because they hadn't got them in working properly.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's efficiencies.
So there was a television that worked, and I was looking at the television. It was Douglas Hurd, who I think was then Home Secretary, and he was saying how Thatcher was going to fight back against Heser and all that. This chap came beside me and said, that guy's good. And I said, yeah, it's Douglas Hurd. And it was Rupert Murdoch. Murdoch was on the floor of the Times to see us through on that day. And that was the first time I met Murdoch, in fact, and it was quite interesting. So yeah, I did write the last and the first splashes, yeah.
Although, if you think about that story, which is just that little point you made there, I was a first year undergraduate at the time at university, so I was, but even though there's a television in the newsroom, it only would have been relevant for 10 minutes twice a day, pretty much, because there was no rolling news, there was no Sky News, there was no News 24, and actually, in the absence of rolling news and a mobile phone and a telephone, it must have been quite hard to have any idea what the hell was going on.
Absolutely. I mean, Matt has it so easy, Absolutely, and it's a piece of cake these days. You know, you've got a phone. You can text your stories on. You've got email. You can email from anywhere. You can email from being on the tube, whatever. In those days, you had to find a phone, and without I mean, there's another story in there about how I got lost in the jungle with Neil Kinnock on one occasion. There was a lobby team of 12. We landed at the wrong airport in Zimbabwe. And the welcoming party was at an airstrip further up the mountain. And we got this fantastic story because Kinnock took on these guys who took us on with their Kalashnikovs. They had no idea who this flame-haired bloke in a bomber jacket shouting at them was, and it was Neil Kinnock. And they locked us in a room, and Kinnock then said, "Right, boys and girls, we're going to keep the spirits up," and he started singing Jerusalem. And the sound of Jerusalem, the strains of Jerusalem went out over the... Anyway, coming back to the subject, Ed, we had to agree then, do we try and find a phone here in the bush, or do we all agree that nobody tries to get this story out until we get to a hotel where we can file it? And we did. 3.5 hours. We were aching to get this story to the world. It was the lead story in every paper that was covered. Because, you know, opposition leader held at gunpoint in Zimbabwe is a good story even today. But we hadn't got it. Like it. And we just hadn't got the technology to get it out. So to answer your question, I've got another story out of my book out.
Yeah. So Gordon Brown had the first mobile phone I ever saw in 1994. It was just like that. And
it was quite a lot of effort for him to throw it then, presumably. But interestingly, not only has journalism totally changed, but also the way that politics is done, in the way that you could stop a story getting out, or the speed that politicians have to react to things. And you're now, you know, you're an accomplished tweeter and Facebook liver and all those things. But that's, you were seeing it from the other side, but technology has changed the way that politics is done as well.
Yeah, it totally has. And it means that there's so much more commentary and opinion and reaction. And even when I started, it was in the early days of BBC outlets competing against each other for stories, because by that time you were starting to get the very early stages of Sky News and then News 24, and if you could be first on BBC Breakfast and get the story moving, and you could and set the agenda rather than the World at One. But that has just hugely accelerated since. I personally don't think the fundamentals have changed, but the pace and the kind of volume. And back in those days, if you wanted to get something on the Today programme, then you needed to have it in a newspaper in advance. And so the newspapers generally led the broadcasters.
Still
whereas
do.
I think
in many ways.
Less so now.
Yeah.
Less so now.
To what extent do you think that Twitter leads the print newspapers and the broadcasters, or just creates so much noise that actually people turn to newspapers and broadcasters and sort of filter it out? Is it helping, or is it a hindrance? Is it just something that goes alongside it? What do you think social media
I think it's really, really accelerate the news cycle and move things on very fast. A good example of this was David Cameron did an interview with the Sunday Telegraph with Paddy Hennessy and I think Matt D'Ancona, where he said that looking across at me in Prime Minister's questions, sometimes he thought I had Tourette's, which was quite a startling thing for him to say. And the Sunday Telegraph, I think, dropped at 8 o'clock. By 9 o'clock on Twitter, there were activists in the disability world saying this is an outrage. By 9:30, already there were people going onto Sky News to comment on what the Prime Minister had said. It wasn't really about me, it was about disability. And I think it got to, by midnight, so this is the day before the paper is actually dropped.
Shops, yeah.
The Sunday Telegraph have to change the headline to Downing Street apologises for Prime Minister's comment. And by the time he went on to the Andrew Marr programme, where the Prime Minister had, David Cameron, had a whole story he wanted to talk about, instead the news line out of it was him having to repeat the apology to Andrew Marr that Downing Street had issued the night before on a headline for a newspaper which at that point hadn't even been published. And that all happened because of the way in which Twitter accelerates the news cycle. In the old days, the paper would have dropped, the Prime Minister would have not said anything
absolutely.
About it, the reaction might have happened by Monday, it would have rolled over a couple of days, where in the end, I think you might have reached the same outcome, potentially, but what social media does, one thing social media does is hugely shrinks down the news cycle and moves things on. So you can have, you know, a new start and a new start and a new reaction over the course of hours. It makes it much, much harder for papers if you are thinking of the physical product, because things move on so fast, which is why these days, you know, the Times and other newspapers will be updating their front all through the day, and what's actually in the physical paper is only part of what you think about as a journalist, whereas 20 years ago, that was the thing that you thought about.
And I think there's a big difference at the Times of the judgment that's made when somebody's buying the paper. It needs to be either adding something, whether that's analysis or moving a story on. It can't just be what people have seen a million times on Facebook.
It can't be straight news. I mean, in my sort of, in recent years, there's absolutely no doubt that Twitter was my fastest source of news. Totally. And that's because of the way journalists operate now. Journalists are as competitive as they ever were. And if you're at an event, you want to be the first to tweet that out. You don't want to be the first to get back to your office and write it. You want to get that out there and be the journalist who got it out there first. So it's changed everything. It's also, I think it's also made generally politicians feel that they're taken less notice of now than they were, in the sense of what they used to do. Speeches to the House of Commons. When I started, you know, we had this team of 12 covering Parliament, covering what was going on.
Just on the Times?
On the Times.
Yeah.
There were 12 gallery team, not all reporters, there was editors as well, just covering the proceedings in the Commons and the Lords, later the European Parliament. There were just three in the lobby. Today they would be just lobby and nobody covering the proceedings.
How much space was that taking up in the paper, covering what was just happening in the Commons?
It was always a full page, 8 columns, a very small print with no ads. So it was a lot of words. It was a lot of words. And it was sort of a mini Hansard in those days when I joined it, which is why you mentioned I had to have quick shorthand in those days. But now, no paper at all. And that, I think, is because of what Ed said. You know, the world has moved on so quickly. Nobody wants to sit around wanting to hear what somebody says in the Commons at 8 o'clock at night. With any luck, somebody might go in to hear the wind-up speeches. But a speech made at 8 o'clock is no good to anyone. An interview on the Green outside Parliament at 5 o'clock is worth a hell of a lot more to an MP.
Well, people still joke now that the best way to keep a secret is to announce it in the House of Commons, and because nobody will notice.
Yeah.
And yet you do it on the Today programme and then it becomes big news. Before we open up to questions, I feel like we need to sort of pick through sort of both of your greatest hits. Let's start with Edwina Covey, because we've already touched on her. But talk us through, Phil. You broke this story, but actually technology and time difference and all of that almost scuppered it.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good chapter in there if you haven't read it. But
I don't know if you know, Phil's got a book.
Yeah. But Edwina Curry wanted her diaries to be serialised in the Times. She wanted the diary. I mean, I think she wanted them to have the cloak of respectability. A publisher came to the Times. Clearly, the Times wouldn't pay as much as the Mail. The Mail would pay four or five times more than us. Publisher came to the Times.
This was before she was on Strictly Come Dancing.
Absolutely. Was she on Strictly? Oh yeah.
Went out the first week.
Oh yeah.
Well, I'm just being the paper of record for the evening.
Yeah. Is that your new party trick now? Somebody names a celebrity and you say which week they
were. All I'm saying is the Mail would have paid more post Strictly.
Yeah, yeah.
That's my point.
Yeah.
So it's not all about Strictly. It is.
I had to read these diaries to see what I thought. And the editor was fairly, have a read, Phil, see what you think. And I read through them and I thought, God, it did happen. There was an affair between John Major and Edwina Curry. And I knew Major extremely well. He'd been somebody I spoke to from the moment I joined the lobby. And so the editor, who was Robert Thompson at the time, said, right, we'll run it. But he made a very important stipulation, which was that he wouldn't run a word until I had got in touch with John Major and told him that I was about to ruin his world. Which I think was only fair. There was an opposite view from the
the lawyers that if we were sure of the story, going to John Major early, before this story was published, could lead to him taking out a privacy injunction under the 98 Act, and this was in 2002, he could have done. But there was no thought. The editor said, I'm not publishing it until you've got him. The day came, it was a Friday, and I went in the office, I wrote it up, I had all John Major's numbers with me, and that was about six different numbers. And I had sat there thinking, when do I call him? And I left it quite late, 5 o'clock, 5:30, tried every single number, no John Major anywhere. And nobody answering the phones either. And I began to think the world has conspired against me. And I got frantic. I was ringing John Major's friends all over the world. I rang somebody in Spain. I rang somebody in France.
Did you think
I knew? People who I knew to be friends.
Did you think you might be in some dodgy hotel in Bayswater?
And they all said, why do you want him? And I couldn't tell them. Anyway, I finally called his a London office at about 7:30. By then I was near panic. And somebody picked up the phone who'd not been there all day and said, why do you want him? I said, I can't tell you. And I just can't tell you, but it's life or death. I must speak to him. And by magic, about 20 minutes later, the phone went, seemed very distant, and it was John Major's special advisor calling me from Chicago. He was in Chicago making a speech. And I, at this point, I had to say, can we stop him making this speech? I need to tell him something. Anyway, the rest is in there.
So what happens? Did you speak to him or did you tell the special advisor?
The rest is in there, man. You know.
That's terrible.
Do you think the special advisor knew?
I got the sense that the special advisor thought that there might be a story out there, but it was hard to tell. The special advisor, just to fill in the story, went and consulted John Major, came back to me and asked if they could have 20 minutes or so. And within 20 minutes, I had a statement from him in which it is now recorded. He said it was the biggest mistake of my life. And I thought, oh my God, that's Monday's story now, because I knew that Edwina, who was at this point hidden in France, wouldn't take too kindly to him saying that. But it did mean that I could then call the office, push the button, and the paper came out.
Presumably,
Norwich beat Preston the next day.
Presumably the security people in Number 10 must have known.
I don't think so.
They were supposed to be in charge of the Prime Minister's security. They could not know where
he was.
It
didn't happen when he was Prime Minister. It was before he was a Prime Minister. It was when he was an MP and then a junior minister.
Okay,
junior whip, actually.
So he didn't carry on at all when he was Prime Minister.
The Tory Whip's office has has a black book.
This sounds like a much better story.
The Tory Whips pride themselves on knowing about everybody's peccadilloes, little secrets, this, that, and the other, and they keep it in a black book. There is a black book, but they keep all these
stories.
There is. There is a black book. And John Major.
They say there isn't now, because they say the last thing you do is you write it down. Don't ever write it down.
I write.
Have you seen it?
I've been told there is it. There was, certainly at that time. But John Major, who was a whip at the time, managed to keep himself out of the whip's book. And that probably was quite an achievement.
Well, there we are. But if you want any more gruesome details about all of that, that's all in...
Goodness. But otherwise, it's a very serious book with all very serious political stories.
Now, Ed, we can't not talk about Gordon Banner, because from the moment you left the Financial Times, you went to work for him, and this is in 1994.
Yep.
So, long way to go to the 1997 election. Talk us through, because there's always a caricature of politicians, but there is a caricature of Gordon Banner. What's he like to work for? What was your experience of being with him?
The thing about Gordon was that he had this huge sense of duty. He was a son of a Scottish Church of Scotland minister, and I think he always felt that he had to be going the extra mile and working hard, and therefore he almost deliberately kept the relaxed, enjoyable, cultured self, very private. And in mine, I talk about, I mean, I have a whole chapter on hinterland and politicians who, Dennis Healy famously, I think I've enjoyed talking about things I'd done in my wider life, like playing the piano or doing marathons. Gordon felt a sort of sense of duty, which meant that he couldn't do that. And, you know, he was always in a suit and he was always working. And when he was off duty, he was very private about that. So I think one of the sad things is that the person, all the way through his time as Chancellor and Prime Minister, was always kept very, very private. There's some things you should keep private. I think he was right to keep his children private. But he himself, he never ever felt he could open up publicly. But when you saw him, he was always kind of fun. He liked to talk and tell stories.
He was a Jekyll and Hyde. Behind the scenes, Gordon could be very, very funny. And Damien McBride in his book told the story of Christmas parties where Gordon got the story wrong every year as he told it, and you lot all burst into it.
But on aeroplanes, he'd always thought we should work.
Go on then. You've mentioned it. Go on then. Tell us the aeroplane story, because this is a cracker. Tell us the story about you and your one Concorde.
Oh, I see. That's
when you nearly died with Gordon Brown.
I actually didn't. Gordon Brown was actually a really interesting person to nearly die with. I think it was like 2002 or 2003, and we were going out to Washington, to New York, and then down to Washington to do a big kind of financial event. And there was a reason why, which I can't remember, why we had to go on Concorde. And this is before Concorde was put out of commission. And it was one of those things where you generally only went on Concorde if you had to. So I went on it 4 or 5 times over the years, and but it wasn't something you just did because you fancied it. And actually, to be honest, it was kind of an odd experience, because Concorde, it was a tiny little plane, and it would whip down the runway really fast and fly up in the air, and everything shook, and you sort of knew you were living in technology which was fabulously far-sighted about 30 years before. So there was a certain vulnerability to it, and we were on the way out . There was a speedometer and then a altimeter in front of you in this very narrow cabin. And we'd got up to Mach 2 or Mach 3. Is that the razor? one of the Machs, whichever one you got to. Mach 2?
It's
really fast.
Fast,
yeah. And we're at 56,000 feet. And then there was this massive shuddering and noise, like we'd hit a wall. But we were on Concorde at 56,000 feet. It was like, and people screamed really loud on this plane. No. But nor did Gordon.
Did Gordon.
We were jolted. And then in front of us, and the plane started going down. And the altimeter went 55,000, 54,000. It was kind of started going down. And then the flight attendant, the cabin director, came on and made an announcement. And the kerfuffle and screaming sort of stopped to hear the announcement. And the announcement was, ladies and gentlemen, there has clearly been a major incident. The captain is currently trying to identify what the incident is. And when he has more information, he'll come back to you. Which was the least stabilising announcement you've ever had on a plane. So down the back.
That's worse than down no the announcement.
Back, they started screaming. Again, and those people who had been enjoying their sort of leather toilet bag, they weren't happy. And and the altimeter kind of kept going down. We got down to about 35,000 feet. It was going down about every 1,000 feet every like 30 seconds. And so Gordon turned to me and said, "Well, this is it." And I said,
That's his lovable, private, upbeat personality.
I think you might be right. And then we had this conversation for about, another 10 minutes about, our lives, our families, what we'd done, what we'd miss, and we had the we're going to hit the ground conversation, which lasted, but then it sort of ran out, and so we got to. And it could about 20, 19, 18,000 feet. And there we were. And so Gordon turned to me and said, "Do you think we should finish the speech?" And I said to him, "No." I am not going to spend the last 5 minutes of my life finishing your bloody speech. Absolutely forget it. So even in that moment, Gordon Brown still thought, I've got 5 minutes left, and we've done sort of life and death and all of that. Maybe we should finish the speech. Again, his mind probably for posterity. And luckily at that point, the plane stabilised. And it turned out that one of the two engines had blown out in a surge. And this happened apparently regularly and or from time to time. And we limped over to New York. But he was actually a really nice person to almost die with.
No, at that point, because you were working for him as an advisor then.
Yeah.
But then, and you talk about this in your book, about how then when you became a cabinet minister,
yeah,
your relationship changed because you had your own domain and you weren't in number 10 all the time.
Yeah.
And... Mm-hmm. You recount, I think it's five times that he talked about or suggested that he might make you Chancellor, but it never happened.
I think actually the Chancellor thing wasn't the problem, which I talk about in here. He did come to me on the day he became leader in July, end of June 2007. He, having done his speech on stage, kind of it was the point where Harriet Harman became deputy, beating Alan Johnson. Gordon became leader of the Labour Party, which meant 2 days later he was going to be Prime Minister. And he grabbed me and pulled me through a door saying, "We must speak," and pulled me through this door. We didn't know where we were going. We ended up in this quite dark like kitchen in some Manchester hotel. And he said to me at that point, "I've been thinking really hard about, and I'm going to be bold, and I'm going to make... David Miliband, Foreign Secretary, you Chancellor, and Jackie Smith, Home Secretary." And I said, "Well, you know that I don't think that I'm not asking for that. I don't think I'm ready to be Chancellor. I'd done an interview with the Mail saying that I didn't think I was ready." But he said he was going to do it. And then a couple of days later, after kind of 48 hours of Gordon-style silence, he then rang again, having said, "The only thing you should spend the next 48 hours doing is working out who's going to be your chief secretary." He then rang me and said, "Can you come round?" And I went round to number 11 and he said, to Treasury, and he said, I can't do it. I just can't. You'll be destroyed. They'll destroy you." And foolishly, I never asked him who they were.
Which was Phil. Is that why do you think Phil would he?
And I then became the children's secretary. But that wasn't. I mean, it was fine because I wasn't asking for a chancellor. Alistair Darling was the obvious person to be chancellor at the time. And a number of times Gordon would debate it and then not do it. The thing which caused me the bigger problem was in the December of that year, when I was about to go on Saturday, I was going to go on the Andrew Marr show. We were about to publish our children's plan. It was a big, our prospectus for, kind of education and children's policy. And he called me into Downing Street on the Saturday and said, "I want you to give up now, being the children's secretary, and come back and become the chief of staff and a cabinet minister in Downing Street. Because when we were at the Treasury together, it worked. You've got to come and do it again." And and I said that I couldn't do it, that I wanted to help, but I'd done that for so many years, and I was now doing this job, and I would, as a politician doing that, it would be impossible. I would be the lightning conductor, which I sort of was anyway, but even worse. And that was the thing which caused real kind of tension, because it's what he wanted, and I didn't deliver. And I felt guilty about that for 3 years, and part of me still feels guilty about it now, but I just didn't feel that I could.
The other, speaking from where I am, the other source of tension there, which Ed is far too coy to mention, was that when it came to Gordon thinking about his succession, who was going to succeed him as Labour leader, he sort of took a neutral line between the two Eds, between Ed here and Ed Miliband, and the office, the Gordon Brown office became aware that, suddenly Gordon Brown was taking a neutral position on the two of them, whereas everybody in that office regarded Ed, as he was, as the senior figure in the office.
Because you both worked for Gordon in the Treasury.
For years, we were now both in the Cabinet.
And then you were both in the Cabinet.
Yeah.
But Ed Miliband in those days was regarded by those of us in the lobby as so far the junior partner to Ed that it was a very strange thing for Gordon to be doing. And when it came to the 2010 leadership election, which David Miliband basically blew, if David Miliband had done however informal a deal with Ed
be, with Ed Bee becoming his shadow chancellor or whatever, David Miliband would have become leader of the Labour Party. There's absolutely no doubt about that. The arithmetic shows it, that when Ed pulled out of that leadership contest, most of Ed's MP votes went to Ed Miliband. Had there been
any... Not pull out, but in the dropout.
Yeah, dropped out. Vote, yes, yeah, sir. Dropped out. I didn't pull out,
despite some people thinking.
You lost, unusually, you lost. But had just even a few more votes gone to David Miliband rather than Ed Miliband, David Miliband would have been leader of the Labour Party.
And do you agree with that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What were those conversations about doing a deal? And
the great irony was that that David Miliband was clearly the Tony Blair candidate. I was clearly the kind of seen as the Gordon Brown continuity candidate. And Ed Miliband managed to come through the middle as neither being Blair or Brown, which, given he'd worked for Gordon for 15 years, was a hell of an achievement. And David and I were never quite clear how he managed to pull
this
off.
Nobody noticed, though.
And,
that was the problem.
Yeah, and then... if you look at I had 40 MPs, they split 2-1 for Ed. It would only have taken two people who voted for me to have gone to David for him to win the contest.
Wow.
So it was
because of the electoral college.
Yeah, that tight. And I think that Ed spoke to every one of the people who voted me first to persuade them to put him second. And I don't think David did. I think David thought that would be, you know, too much of a concession, too much of a reach. He thought he could do it without sort of reaching out in that way. I mean, I was never going to choose between the two of them because I wanted to work for whoever, because I wanted to hold the Labour Party together. And so deal is not quite the right word in the sense that, you know, it wasn't like we were going to form an alliance. But if David had said, you know, this is what I intend to do, that would have been enough. And as Phil says in his book, very many senior people were urging David to do that or make that statement.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
Peter Mandelson, for one, Peter Mandelson was saying to David, do a deal with Ed Balls.
And do you think then that David would have won in 2015?
Look, the nature of politics is that you can never know what the counterfactual is. You never know what would have been. So how can you know? I think that Dave and Ed were more similar rather than more different. And, you know, they were brothers. And that was... And I think also the thing which did for us in the end and then up to 2015 was in the context of a hung parliament, the idea that the SNP would hold the whip hand in parliament over a Labour prime minister. And I think that would have been a problem whoever was leader of the Labour Party. And I think actually Ed would have did a better job of unifying the Labour Party during that period than David would have done. On the other hand, I think we suffered greatly because we were not seen as a party which would work with business and wealth creators, which I worried about all the time. I think David would have been in a better place on that. So in this balance of things, how do you know how it would have gone? You can't say categorically at all, but my instinct is that the result would have not been different.
I'm not sure I agree. I think David Miliband would have looked a credible prime minister, whereas Ed never did. And I think that was the difference when you come down to how close the result was in 2015. But we'll never know.
Well, of course, if the 2015 result hadn't happened, we wouldn't have had the... I mean, in a difficult year, the 2016 has been, the joy of a Saturday night of... For political journalists to sit down on a Saturday night with their families with a glass of wine and say, oh, no, it's for work. And to delight in Ed Balls doing Lord knows what on national television. Talk us through, because we'll come on to questions in a moment, and I'm sure you've all got questions about this extraordinary period in British history. Talk us through why you did it and... I was really struck looking back because when the awful news came through over the weekend where you'd
awful news
your sad demise I looked back at lots of the pictures from to do a sort of little montage for the email. And actually, in the first week, you were really boring. You had a suit on and a sort of sparkly tie. And then something happened in the second week with a banjo. And then you were sort of reborn as this extraordinary sort of camp character.
I think...
what the hell happened?
I think the reality is, for the people who didn't know me, this was a big surprise, and people who know me well, this is how I've always been. So there's been no big change. I think I never ever thought I would do this, but when they came to me in this spring, I told Yvette, thinking she would say, "Don't be ridiculous," and she said, "Of course you've got to do it." She said,
"Just wanted you out of the house."
The most no, she said, "I'd love to do it myself. It's the most amazing program. You will lose weight and learn to dance, which we've always wanted to do together." And she said that if you look back in 15 years' time, or, you know, and you sort of never know when things are going to happen, if you look back and say, "I had that chance and I turned it down," I think you'll always regret it. And she said, "Politics is in such flux at the moment. Just go and do something just for its own sake." And I thought she was mad. But then I then spoke to Jeremy Vine, who had done it last year, and he said it was the most life-affirming experience of my life, and I would absolutely do it again, and you should definitely do it. And so I thought about it and thought, well, actually, you know, why not? Because what an amazing thing it would be to step into that world. And I learned a huge amount. I mean, in passing, I thought people were joking that they sprayed on tans. But people...
This is going to be worse than the Edwina Covey stuff.
People really do it. And I would go... You know, I actually had a couple. And people spray tans on. It's amazing. But anyway, put that to one side. I learned a really interesting thing about performance, which is if you are a politician, although there's a lot of performance, House of Commons, on television, live television, all those kind of things, in the end, you're always being yourself. And in that first week, when I walked out, you know, not totally sure what the hell I was doing here, in a suit with Big Ben behind me to do the waltz, it was me. And I was stood there thinking, and I'd refused to have no tans, no sparkles or anything. Compared to all the other contestants, I looked like the BBC health and safety guy who was saying, "Yes, you're fit to dance, no, no." And although my waltz actually wasn't bad, I looked like I was... Well. I wasn't bad, I'm told. I looked like I was kind of not really having a very good time, is the truth. And then Darcy Bustle said, the famous ballerina and judge, she said, "You've got to assume a character and play a role." Jeremy Vine said to me a couple of weeks ago, "Throw yourself into it." And I didn't know what he meant. And I sort of discovered over the next couple of weeks the Charleston, but then in particular, being the mask and the yellow suit and the green face, that you could sort of put yourself to one side and you could perform as a character and you could really enjoy it and have a real go. And that was a big transformation. I learned a huge amount about performance about that. And then, of course, there was Gangnam, which was in the week of the American presidential election, which I thought, by the way, Hillary Clinton was still going to win until about 2:12 on the morning when all the probabilities shifted really hard. On the Monday, it's a great piece of music, Gangnam, but not easy to pull off as a dance. And Katya had said
evidently.
All I can say is, I'd like to see you try.
And it's not that sort of evening.
And Katya said to me, she said, "We've spent Sunday choreographing, me and..." Because it was a Saltzer, another choreographer called Jenny. She said, "It's going to be epic, I believe." And then after, you know, and the next day we actually did a first go through, and I took it home, filmed it on the iPhone, and showed it to Yvette and the family, and they all went, "What?" But then Donald Trump gets elected. overnight. So then on the Wednesday, I actually genuinely, I went in thinking, you know, we've just elected this guy as president, and I'm supposed to spend all day doing the salsa with a 27-year-old Russian. And what has happened to my life? And I had to really kind of think through what this meant. But then on Twitter all that day, there was people saying, it's terrible, but at least we can look forward to Ed Balls doing Gangnam on Saturday. And I sort of thought, well, actually, you know, maybe, you know, in a small way, I have a contribution to make still to public life.
I think you made a very big contribution that week.
The interesting thing, just to let you in on a secret, I mean, it's actually quite a hard move, is what we call the pony, where you sort of jump in and start doing that. And although it looks quite dramatic, if you don't give it enough drama, it's very hard for my partner to get hold. So she would actually yell at me during the week that I was giving insufficient oomph to my jump, and could I up it a bit, just to sort of lay the gauntlet down to Matt. And then on the Friday and Saturday, all the production people really enjoyed it. And so actually, on that, it's such a ridiculous thing to say. On the Saturday night, I was about to go on live, 10 million people, I'm thinking to myself, you know, like, you know, that lift which didn't work a couple of weeks ago, if I mess this up, before I get to the oomph moment, I'll have really let the nation down. And therefore, I've really, really concentrated on trying to get to the point where it worked. And at that point, you know, when I was 7 or 8 in the playground in primary school, I think people used to, you know, we used to mess around doing Jimmy Hill beards or pretending to be not the 9 o'clock news or saying it's Friday, it's 5 o'clock and it's crackerjack. And 40 years on, I get lots and lots of texts and emails from parents saying that their kids spent Sunday and Monday in the playground doing our Gangnam model across the playground or across the sitting room. And you sort of think, what an amazing thing to do something which has that kind of reach. It had 3.5 million hits on Facebook within 24 hours. And I mean, it's ridiculous.
It was.
But at the same time, it brought, you know, whether you are, because we're talking it very politically here, whether you support Norwich or Ipswich, whether you're Labour or Conservative, whether you're English or Scottish, you could all unite and say, we actually quite enjoyed seeing the ridiculous sight of Ed Balls and Catchy Jones doing Gangnam on BBC Strictly. Yeah. And that's rather a nice thing to have done in your life. I'm quite proud of that. Can I tell you one other story?
I have to say, my 7-year-old daughter, no offence to you, Phil, but my 7-year-old daughter was very excited that I was coming to see you tonight and said to say hello to Ed. So I like to think I've...
That dancer.
I've done that.
No, Ed Ball's that dancer.
Yeah, who I know from work.
The dancer off Strictly.
Off of Strictly. But go on, then. You've got one more story.
We had our very last night on Saturday, and... it was totally the right thing for me to go out, so no issue at all. It was definitely right. The others were all much better. But as we were going up these rickety stairs you go up before you go out onto the actually to walk down the walkway, and we've done that every week now for 11 weeks, 10 weeks, and 11 including the first show. And you sort of hang around there and you can hear all the music and the audience is getting built up, and there's a comedian guy who whips it all up and the music, and then finally it goes live. And as we were standing there on these rickety steps, Katya Jones, my Russian professional partner, turned to me and said, she said, there's one thing I just want to ask you before we go out and do this. And I said, what is it? And she said, it's just one thing I just want you to clear up. This is totally true. In that minute, as the theme music is playing, she says, every time the warm-up guy makes this joke where he says that you think it was bad for Ed Balls, think how much worse it was for his sister Ophelia. She said, I don't understand. Yes. She said, why is it a joke? She said, it's a really nice name. And I said, well, because you think about it, Ophelia. And she said, it's a really nice name. And I suddenly realised that, you know, this amazing choreographer, dancer, world champion, you know, her first language is Russian. She's from St. Petersburg. So I had to say, Ophelia.
And at this point, the curtain's
Ophelia.
Open.
And she went, oh, that's why it's funny. And then we went and danced.
Well, on that note.
At that moment, I realised that she was actually a Russian
dancer.
Yeah, and not a fan of 1970s Carry On films. unlike some of us.
Thank you for downloading. To discover more, head to thetimes.co.uk.